I'm still having those awful dreams.
5, 6, grab your crucifix.
Teresa!
Have you ever done that before? Pull someone into your dream?
The fact that we all dreamt about this guy before we ever met doesn't seem to impress anybody.
In the name of Lorik, Prince of Elves, demon be gone.
Teresa!
You want me to prescribe an experimental psychoactive drug to a bunch of suicidal teenagers?
I know who's trying to kill you.
Don't humor us. We're not in the mood.
He wears a dirty brown hat. He's horribly burned. He has razors on his right hand. You are the last of the Elm Street children.
This is it, Jennifer. Your big break in TV.
Teresa!
Up the prime time, bitch!
The young girl on the staff was accidentally locked in here over the holidays. When they found her, she was barely alive and with child. That girl was Amanda Krueger. Her child, Freddy. The bastard son of 100 maniacs.
Souls of the children, give me strength.
In the name of Toya, Princess of Pop, Guff be gone.
Let's go kick the motherfucker's ass all over Dreamland.
This is Jared McVeigh from Island of Blood, a.k.a. Whodunit, and you're listening to The Hysteria Continues.
And indeed you are. Welcome back to The Hysteria Continues. It's episode 137, and it's third time around to Elm Street as we're getting back up and close with Freddy. And this is your choice, I believe, Eric.
It is indeed.
Okay, yes. So we thought it's about time to return to Elm Street and work our way through the sequels. And obviously, it'll be interesting to see how we feel about this one. I think there may be a messy split, but we'll come on to that later. But in time, on a tradition, well, actually, first of all, how is everyone doing? We haven't recorded for a little while, have we?
What, 2 weeks?
2 weeks. Well, it's a little while, isn't it? We're going to have another little... Well, it's 2 weeks. It's a fortnight. It's an age. But Eric, how are you doing?
I'm doing good, and I'm hearing a big echo in my headphones, which is distracting me a bit, but...
Okay, well, let's see. Let's power through. Let's see if we can... we might have a little Skype. Maybe it's Freddy messing with us. Who knows? Maybe we're in dream therapy. Let's see what kind of oral torture we're going to have. Actually, talking of oral torture, as in AU rather than OR, although I'm sure Eric's a master of that as well.
Hey.
There's going to be a special treat or trick at the end of the show, and it's been teased on the Facebook group or something, saying you might need a drink at the end of the show. I know I will. Wait until the very end, the bitter end, for kind of... How can I put it? Wait and
awesome.
See.
Awesome.
Well,
amazing.
Well, let our listeners be the judges of that. But
Life-changing,
yes, it could be. Yeah, life-changing. Like they say, life-changing injuries, yes. Joseph, Joseph, how are you?
I'm good, Justin. But I want to know, where do you keep the bourbon?
Well, I usually... actually, the bourbon I keep in the drinks cabinet is the vodka I hide in the cistern.
I'm sorry, let me rephrase that. Where do you keep the fucking bourbon?
Well, the fucking bourbon. That is very rude.
That's what Freddy says. So.
I know.
Yeah, but Freddy's bold.
He's a potty
man. You don't have
to
lower yourself to his level just because it's cool. Because you think it's cool.
Talking of swearing, I'll talk about a little bit of swearing in a minute, but I just want to see how Nathan's doing. How are you doing, Nathan?
Okay.
Okay, yeah. A man of few words, but we are back to, well, we're back to Elm Street, but actually before we get on to that, I'm just going to say we had a Silence of the Lambs themed evening last night, so we watched the Silence of the Lambs on the big screen, and did you know there was a Silence of the Lambs musical?
No.
Yes, I was going to record a clip, but I didn't get a chance to do it, but it was on the Castro. It's very kind of rude. There's a song, it's called If I Could Smell Your Cunt, which is kind of, I know, talking swearing, which we played some extracts from yesterday, which was quite funny. And then we also played the French and Saunders version of Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, yes, I remember that. That's funny.
With the Crankies and Bernie Clifton and all those comedians in the cells. But anyway, if you're not British or Irish, or you probably won't get that reference. But that was all good times had by all. But in time on a tradition, let's talk about what we've been watching in those mammoth 2 week break we've had between shows. So Nathan, do you want to go first?
Sorry, missed what you said there, Justin.
Oh, I said Nathan. Sorry.
Okay.
Nathan,
Barb Girl.
Oh, me. Okay. I watched the Belko Experiment.
Ooh, and?
And it's really, really good. It's, actually, it's really good. Like, I loved it. Like, it doesn't take long to get started. I mean, you know, you probably get, like, maybe 10 minutes of getting to know the characters, and then, you know, the craziness starts. So, but, I mean, it's very violent, too. It's one of those movies where if somebody gets their head caved in, you see it all on screen.
why are you laughing, Eric?
People dying and stuff. Fantastic.
Anyway, let's move Eric to his own private padded cell. But Nathan, that sounds good. Did you see it, Joseph, as well? It's out at the cinemas, isn't it, in the States?
It is out here, but I have not seen it yet.
Okay. Eric, have you seen it in your inverted commas, air quotes, cinema?
No, I have not seen it, Justin, because it hasn't been legitimately released over here yet.
Okay, well, just as well. So, it's one, but it's being compared to Battle Royale, hasn't it? Is it kind of?
It looks very like it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's very similar. You know, the general idea, anyway.
Mm. Okay, well, that's one to look forward to. Anything else, Nathan?
No, that was actually all I've seen recently.
Okay, well, thank you. Joseph, how about you?
I have not watched anything in the past 2 weeks, so you can just skip me.
Okay, right. Okay, well, this could be a short show. Eric, how about you?
Okay, I watched, and I watched this legitimately before you say anything, Justin. It was on Film 4 during the week. Like Belko Experiment, it's set in a high-rise, and it's called High-Rise. It's Ben Wheatley's second most recent film, because I think he has a new one out this week. So he's the director of Kill List and Sightseers, which we covered on the show last year, maybe the year before, and a film that I really, really love. This one is based on the J.G. Ballard novel, and it's set in a kind of fictional, slightly futuristic 1970s. So it looks amazing. But in the movie, sort of the upper classes live on the higher floors and the chavs live on the lower floors. And the plot as such is driven more by allegory and metaphor than it is by a narrative. And that's probably why I couldn't engage with the film at all. It's a very odd film. It's quirky and offbeat, but it could have done with having just one character with one foot in reality, or because everyone does acts in an irrational manner and everyone is quirky and weird, and I just couldn't engage with the film at all. It reminded me kind of my reaction to the Japanese film Uzumaki. Do you remember that one, Justin? It's the one where the town is overtaken with an obsession with spirals.
Oh yes, yeah,
yeah,
yeah.
And again, that one, yeah. That film, it's a film of you know, certain set pieces that were very good, but as a whole I found the film unengaging. And the same with High Rise. It could probably do with a second viewing, but I don't know if I'd be that enthused about going back to it for a second time. I mean, there are parts of it that I thought, oh, that's quite good, that's quite interesting. But for a two-hour movie, it just couldn't hold my interest. I don't know if you've seen it.
I've seen half of it. So I can't remember. I didn't see the second half, but it's on Amazon or Netflix. So I might catch up the rest of it at some point. But yeah, it looks amazing, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, it's stunning. The sort of odd 1970s kitsch look, but I'm a bigger fan of Sightseers than I am of his other movies that I've seen. So.
Talking of Sightseers, have you seen the trailer for Prevenge?
No, but I hear it's really, really good. It's I can't remember the actress's name.
It's Alison Lowe. Is it Alice?
Alice Lowe. Yeah, she's directed it as well, hasn't she? Is starring in it.
Mm. If you don't know about this, I mean, I haven't seen it yet. I've seen the trailer. It's Alice Lowe, who was the half of Sightseers duo, the angry face.
The one who talks about the brown lipstick.
Brown lipstick, yeah. She plays a heavily pregnant woman whose unborn baby directs her to kill. So it could fit into our little niche, perhaps. That's worth, hopefully worth a watch. Is there anything else?
Yeah, one other thing I watched last night was Fright Night has just come out. The 1985 version has just come out on a special edition Blu-ray over here under the Eureka label. Now, the film is great fun, and it was a real surprise to me when I saw it back in the 80s because I generally don't like vampire movies that much. But this one is much more of a kind of a typical 1980s monster movie, which is probably why I like it so much. And it steers away from, you know, there's films like Bram Stoker's Dracula and Interview with the Vampire that I just don't like at all. I find them deathly dull, I'm afraid. But thankfully, this, you know, doesn't fall into that category. What attracted me mainly to the Blu-ray was just how many dozens of extras there is on it, particularly the documentary You're So Cool, Brewster, which is 146 minutes, which is a good hour longer than the actual movie. Well worth picking up. It's like the documentary itself is worth the price alone. It's really in depth, and it involves everyone still alive that was involved in the making of the film. So it's really, really terrific. And, you know, it would rival something like Never Sleeps Again for, although it does just cover the first Fright Night film, obviously. But yeah, I loved it.
It's Second Sight, isn't it? I think put that out. And I think it was. Was it Second Sight? I can't remember. But it was.
It's Eureka. Eureka.
Sorry, a Eureka label. But it's only like £12.99 or something.
It was really reasonably priced for kind of a niche title, and it comes with like it's a dual disc, so it's a DVD. There's a DVD of the same content as well.
Cool. I've never seen Fright Night Part 2 because that's a bit of a not a lost film, is it? But it's not.
I saw that in the cinema back in the day.
Oh, did you?
Yeah. It's good. I think it's more of the same, I don't think it got great reviews. But to me, it's kind of a very similar movie. Maybe that's why it didn't get good reviews.
Okay. But, excellent. Well, thank you, Eric. Well, sort of from around about the same time, I was watching the new House Arrow box set over the last few days.
No, you weren't.
Absolutely. Sorry, it's a little private joke there. I've been watching a few things. I watched Night of the Living Deb, which I'm not really going to talk much about, but it was like a zombie rom-com with the emphasis really on the kind of rom-com. It was kind of mildly amusing, but it quickly got a bit tedious after the first sort of 20 minutes or so. So I take it none of you have seen that. Is that...
I've never heard of it.
No, but it was.
I've heard of it, but I haven't seen.
Yeah, well, it's something to watch while you're darning socks or something like that. So maybe they could put that on the DVD box when it comes out. The other one I caught up again with, I hadn't seen for years, was Night Watch, which was the, I think it's Danish, from the one that was remade with Ewan McGregor in 1997. This one was from 1994, and it had it's got quite recognisable people in it. And the main guy is the guy Nikolai something or other. I can't remember his full name.
So recognisable.
From Game of Thrones, he's probably most recognisable as Jaime Lannister. He plays, and his best friend is, if you're into your kind of Nordic crime, his best friend in it is was the main one half of the crime fighting duo from The Bridge, and also his girlfriend in it was the main character in The Killing, the original sort of Danish or Swedish, whatever it won, whichever one it was. But this one was set, it's basically a night watchman who starts working in a hospital, and he has to go around and do the rounds each night. And part of that means it has got like a key and a lock. He has to go around the turn to show he's been there. And one of them is right at the end of this morgue, because he has to walk through every time. And there's a serial killer, and the bodies of the murder victims turn up in the morgue, and he kind of gets caught up in the whole thing. So it's a really good film. I really, really like it. I haven't seen it for, I think I may have seen it when it first came out, so well over 20 years ago now. But is that one you've seen, Eric, is it?
I did, but it has been 20 years as well, so I can't remember much about it. I saw the Ewan McGregor one as well, but again, can't remember much about either of them.
No. What about Nathan and Joseph? Have you seen it?
I've seen both of the Night Watch films. Mm. I just don't remember anything about them.
Mm. Well, they're definitely worth another watch if you've not caught up with it recently, or if you're listening, you've never seen them. Definitely worth a watch. So,
I've seen both of them.
Oh, have you? Okay. Did you like them?
Yeah. Yes, I like both of them. And I really liked the remake because it's, I think it's the one I remember the best at the moment. But I like the remake. And there's a really good prank in it that if I had been pranked that way, it may have ended the friendship.
Okay.
But there's like a scene where he's working at a morgue, you know, he's working at the morgue and he keeps hearing something and, you know, he goes into the room and there's like bodies under white sheets and one of them raises up and scares him to death and it's a friend playing a joke on him.
I know.
That would be very funny.
That was in the original as well. But I just, can you imagine actually going into a morgue, turning the lights out and going under a blanket surrounded by those dead bodies just for a joke?
Isn't that how like Susie goes to sleep at night?
Yeah, it is. It's a very goth thing to do, Justin. You've probably done that in your time.
Oh, every night. So I kind of ring a bell and Toya comes down because she puts the mop away. The only other one I was going to mention.
Not hear her casting her magical spell in the intro.
Yeah, it didn't work though, did it?
No.
It was the other film I watched was I'm Not a Serial Killer.
I've seen that, which
came out recently, which is kind of gone, which is which I thought was really good. It's kind of atypical sort of not teen horror movie, but like a teen protagonist who is a sociopath, and there's murders going on in his hometown, but they're really kind of gruesome people, like being pulled apart and bits of their bodies taken, and then he starts to suspect his elderly neighbor, who's played by Christopher Lloyd, that's the one, yeah.
Oh, is it? Sorry.
Yeah, and so without, I don't want to give any more away, but it goes off, it takes a very, very kind of strange tangent, it goes off in a very strange direction, and in a quite rewarding direction about halfway through, but it's very well done. I thought that was really good. But you've seen that?
Yes, it's an Irish, well, it's kind of an Irish-UK co-production.
Yeah.
The director is Irish. I saw that.
That's why
I liked it. Yeah. I was chatting to a girl at work who's a filmmaker herself, and she liked it as well up until the sort of final 15 minutes when she thought it got a bit stupid. Mm. But she wouldn't really be she likes horror to a degree, but she wouldn't be as enthusiastic as we are. So I was forgiving of those final 15 minutes. I thought they were quite good. So.
Yeah. Yeah. But you've seen that as well, Joseph.
I started watching that on Netflix. I got about 15 minutes in, and for one reason or another, I got distracted and I haven't gone back to it, but I want to. It was kind of intriguing what I saw of it.
No, it's definitely worth a watch. What about you, Nathan?
No.
I would recommend it. It's also good because it has that kind of weird feel, which I think sometimes kind of really works when you've got somebody who's not of the country where the film's been made. So it's got people in it that you wouldn't normally see in a lot of American horror movies or movies generally, people who just look normal. Do you know what I mean? Like people you would see every day in Walmart, that type of thing. People who aren't sort of airbrushed, and you know, there's some very beautiful people in it. Some of the main characters, but all the peripheral characters are all kind of, sort of, most of them are elderly and just kind of, you know, kind of feel like non-actors. So it's quite a kind of refreshing take on that kind of small town Americana. But anyway, that was that. But talking of going from, well, we, you know, I'm just trying to think. We haven't got a quiz or any other thing, have we really? Unless, Nathan, you're going to talk about what happened after the credits or...
Well,
we'll do that after the film.
I don't. Yeah, I was about to say, like, I don't know if my end credits will work on this one because we kind of know what happens from anybody that's seen part four. I mean, it doesn't pick up exactly where this left off, but you get a good idea of where they're at.
Okay.
At the beginning of part four.
What I will tell you about after the credits is that Kristen gets much fatter. Oops.
God. She does gain a friend who's got huge hair too.
She does.
She may be of the cockroach persuasion.
Maybe
I don't really remember that well.
Eric and I had an interesting chat on. Well, it was not much of a chat. You know, a lot of times when I say stupid stuff on our chats, you guys ignore me completely.
What?
I think I don't notice that.
Oh, he's getting rhubarb lady already.
No, but I have a Roundtable Algonquin question.
Oh, okay.
And I didn't let you guys prep for it because I wanted, like, you know, just your reactions without prepping for it.
Ooh, it's like when they filmed Chestburster in Alien.
Yes, I'm very innovative like this. So we were talking about, you know, the. I made a joke that I thought it was rude of Jason in Friday the 13th Part 2 to kill Mark before he had a chance to have sex with Vicky. I thought that was very rude of him. But we were talking about how, you know, generally, I guess, aside from the killing, he's not, I guess, not necessarily rude. But do you guys, can you think of any killer in a slasher movie that, I mean, just taking killing out of it, is just a rude person? Would you consider Freddy rude? I don't think I would, because I think he's joking, and I think jokes are okay.
Well, they end in people dying, don't they? So I think he's being quite rude.
Yeah, but the death part, I mean, like, if you take the death part out of it, I guess. Because, I mean, all of them.
He comes in waving a house four-disc box set, saying, well, look what I've got, and then runs off to watch it. That would have been rude if he'd done that.
That would have been rude. Well, I suppose.
Justin, do you think Hannibal is rude?
No, because he actually says in the she says at the end of the first film that he wouldn't come after her because he would deem that as rude. So I think Hannibal has his own etiquette, even though it's kind of.
I think he is quite rude. I'm sorry.
In what way? Well, I mean, the fact of killing people is quite rude, isn't it?
Were you not brought up to? Did your mum not tell you to if you can't say anything nice, don't say anything at all? And he doesn't do that. He just says it like it is, as people say, and he. He delivers some home truths to her, and he doesn't even know her.
Well, that's not necessarily rude, is it? This
is
being
direct. It is rude.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yeah.
So you don't like home truths then, Eric?
No.
Okay. Okay. But I was trying to think of anyone. I imagine sort of Pamela Voorhees is a bit rude, wasn't she?
Well, because she was slapping Adrian King around.
She was. Yeah.
Well, and
she
also it's like Adrian King didn't have anything to do. Well, actually, none of the camp counselors had anything to do with her with Jason drowning.
Right.
So
you know, what I thought of as rude, the killer from Happy Birthday to Me.
In what way?
I mean, when you just in that. First of all, I think they're kind of, you know, painted as snobbish anyway.
Mm.
As a big snob, but then I don't know, like the reason behind the killings, and like it really sucks for many of the ones who died. When you know, when you think of what exactly sin were they guilty of, and I'm like, oh yeah, they went to a party.
Exactly, yes, but I think any killer is probably rude, aren't they, to some degree. I think there's, you know, there is a social murder is a social faux pas. No, faux pas.
Faux pas.
Faux pas. God, I can't speak today. Could put my teeth back in. But it's an interesting one. We should probably throw that open to our dear listeners, and if they can give us a good rude one.
Yeah, somebody that's just generally a mean person. Like if they weren't killing, they would still be just a mean person.
Because a lot of killers, actually, in horror films, slasher films, have got, like, a certain pathos to them, haven't they? Not exactly like Frankenstein's monster, but a lot
like
of them...
Like Prom Night.
Like Prom Night or Fatal Games or, you know, sort of there's you know, something going on that there's something tragic, isn't there? There's not too many kind of complete asshole killers.
Asshole victims.
That's why I was wondering if anybody could think of anyone, because I was thinking to myself that most of the time, I mean, even though they're... motives are crazy and, you know, they're being just insane. Like I was trying to think of any of them, if they weren't killing and nothing tragic, I guess it happened, they'd still just be a completely mean person.
Yeah. Well, I kind of guess someone like in Final Exam, because he has no backstory, does he? He's just he just kills.
That's true. He's just a random murderer.
Yeah. Yeah, but pretty much all the other kind of slasher movie villains have got some kind of backstory, haven't they? Or some reason to be killing, apart from Final Exam. I'm trying to think of any others. The killer, I tell you, one of the killers who is quite rude is the one in The Dawn That Dripped Blood.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Oh, yeah, he is.
Oh, sorry, he or she is, I mean.
Yeah. Well, especially what they do to the final girl at the end of the film. That was rude.
Yeah. Oh, and the killer in Evil Laugh.
Mm.
that person, anytime we saw, I mean, well, it's hard to say it without spoiling it, but, you know, that person struck me as being very mean, like, regardless.
Also, the killer in Visiting Hours as well. He was not a very nice person, was he?
No.
I would probably say the killer in the first Urban Legend, just because of the whole parka thing.
Ding, ding, ding!
And the hair, yeah.
Although the killer in Urban Legend did have a reason, wasn't there? A tragedy.
See, I'm trying to think of context here. I'm trying to remember if there's any slasher movie villains who just go around farting all the time.
Rude.
Yeah, that's rude. That's the context I'm looking for.
I'll tell you somebody who is an asshole who's in Blood Rage with the twin.
Oh yeah,
because he's a real asshole, isn't he?
Oh yeah.
But yeah.
What a jerk.
So okay, well, thank you, Nathan, for that. So let's see if there's any other rude killers out there. We'll have a think. But in the meantime, shall we take a trip to Elm Street?
Yes, please, Mummy.
Okay, well, here is the trailer for A Nightmare on Elm Street 3, Dream Warriors.
Born the bastard son of 100 maniacs, demented killer Freddy Krueger is back for fresh victims in this hallucinatory shocker co-written by original creator Wes Craven. The last of the Elm Street kids are now at a psychiatric ward where Freddy haunts their dreams with unspeakable horrors. Their only hope is dream researcher and fellow survivor Nancy Thompson, Heather Langenkamp of the original Nightmare, who helps them battle the supernatural psycho on his own hellish turf. So my relationship with this movie goes back quite a long way. I had an ex-rental copy of it back in the day when my video collection consisted of this and possibly a couple of other ex-rental titles, you know, along with a few films that I taped off the television, because remember, this was the years before A, I had any money because I was still in school, and B, before the internet and the abundant gifts that the baby Jesus was to bestow on avid horror fans like myself. So as my video collection was quite limited, I tended to watch the same movies over and over and over again, and this happened to be one of those films. So my initial reaction in the late 80s upon seeing Dream Warriors was, wow, that was totally awesome. And it delivered everything I wanted. It was fun, it had weird special effects, it had vibrant characters. But I think I watched it one too many times. In the same way that I watched Jason Lives and the original Elm Street, they were the other ex-rental copies I had. I watched them too many times. And it's like pop songs, I suppose, which at first seem really catchy and appealing, but overexposure tends to lessen their impact. So,
Toya.
What else? Oi! Toya's impact has never gone.
It was never here in the first place.
I was talking about...
What? No, nothing. Carry on.
You said something horrible. You said something rude now.
You have to listen back.
Anyway, Dream Warriors, for me, is an excellent film. And I can totally see why I loved it back in the day. But I no longer really enjoy watching it. And it's my own fault for watching it a gajillion times back in the late 80s. So this entry really sets in stone the template for all the subsequent sequels, bar New Nightmare. This is the first time we see the ironic deaths, where each character is given kind of one particular character trait that Freddy will use against them. So the kid who's interested in puppets is turned into a puppet. The kid who wants to be an actress gets killed by a television, etc. And this is also the first time that Freddy really comes out of the shadows and takes center stage. He's almost the main character in this one. I mean, we saw a good bit of him in Freddy's Revenge, but here he's a lot more dialogue, and, you know, his trademark quips come much more to the fore, you know, most famously in Welcome to Primetime, Bitch, I suppose is the most quotable line from this entry in the series. Also, it's the first one that starts that trend of killing off the survivors of previous movies. So, spoiler alert, in this one, Heather Langenkamp and John Saxon don't make it to the end of the film, I'm afraid. They almost do, but not quite. And then in 4 and 5, they do the same thing, where they start off each entry by killing the survivors of the previous film, which I know is something that Nathan is not going to like. We know his track record with the start of Friday the 13th Part 2, so God knows what he's going to make of returning characters in Nightmare on Elm Street sequels. I'll get to that later. This also sets up the origin story with Amanda Kruger appearing in it. She becomes an important part of Part 5 in particular. So in many ways, it's kind of the ground zero for the subsequent Nightmare on Elm Street series after this. But it's also overtly mainstream, far more mainstream than the first two movies. And as a result, it looks kind of dated. It looks very 80s. Now, this is, as I always say, that's a very good thing, in my opinion. It mightn't work maybe for a sort of younger audience, but it looks almost like a horror version of St. Elmo's Fire. It sort of has that dated big hair, shoulder pad 80s look, which I love. Also, some of the effects. When I was watching this as a 14-year-old, I always imagined that the budget for this must have been about $25 million, which it isn't. And I can see that now, looking back. Some of the effects are kind of shoddy. Freddy's makeup is terrific in it, I think. I still prefer the way he looks in Part 2. I think it's my favourite makeup for Freddy. The puppet sequence is brilliant, and it's quite graphic for, as I was saying, this was mainstream, but that was quite a graphic sequence. The Freddy snake is less convincing, I think. It looks a bit chonky, I thought. Also, all the Dungeons and Dragons stuff is kind of, well, the effects are kind of hokey, but also I think the character is a bit too lightweight, possibly, for a horror movie. I'm not 100% sure if everyone will agree with me on that. So the plot as well is kind of ludicrous. This is the first film where the first of the Elm Street films where I thought, how on earth can they blame that on suicide? In particular, I'm thinking of the scene where the girl has her head stuck through the television. Lawrence Fishburne's character walks into the room, and she's about 3 or 4 feet off the ground with her head in a television set, and they just automatically assume it was a suicide. I don't quite know how you would manage to do that. Even with kind of a springboard in front of the television, you'd still want to be, you know, heading towards the screen with some force. Don't get me started on the waterbed death in Part 4, because that's even more ludicrous, how they just don't bother, you know, nobody sort of thinks something odd is going on here. It feels like I'm dissing the movie quite a bit. I'm not. I do, as I said, when I look back on it, I can see totally why I loved it at the time. Over-familiarity has lessened its impact, as I said, and it's one of the Elm Street films I never go back to anymore. The characters are all quite likable there, and you've got your Boo Hiss pantomime villain in the head of the clinic, played by Priscilla Pointer. The dream sequences are very inventive. I particularly like the Where's the Fucking Bourbon scene, as we were talking about earlier, which always reminds me now of Justin, because he would be... The second you invite him into your home, he'd be looking for the booze, I imagine. Would I be wrong, Justin?
Oh, well, no, because I always take some with me, a little hip flask.
All right, okay, fair enough. I love the TV sequence. I love the cameos by Zsa Zsa Gabor and Dick Cavett. That's always made me chuckle, that scene. So as I said, it's Dream Warriors is the one that suffered most for me because of watching it too many times back in the day. So Part 2 would still be my favourite Elm Street entry, I would have to say at this stage, in terms of rewatchability nowadays. All that aside, Once Upon a Time, it was one of my favourite films of all time. So I'm going to still give it a big thumbs up. Just don't watch it a million times like I did, because it will wear out its welcome, possibly. Nathan, I'll go to you first, because I'm curious to know how you feel about... main characters from previous movies being killed off in sequels.
I don't like it.
I thought as much.
I don't like it at all. I think, because to me, I feel like if you survived one, then I think you should be invincible after that. I don't like that you survived a traumatic experience only to end up dead anyway. Like, then what was the point? You might as well just killed me in the first one.
Yep.
Because if you're going to let me survive and make me feel great and let me get all the newspaper, you know, articles about me and let me, you know, go on, you know, any of the major talk shows and get to talk about my story for all of like 5 minutes and then I die like a day later and everybody's going to remember me as, can you remember that poor idiot that survived a massacre to die like 2 days later? Like, that's what I would become. No, I'd rather just be an unfortunate victim in the original. But yeah, so I don't like that at all. But I don't mind it as much in this one, only because Heather Langenkamp does come back later on, playing herself. But still, I mean, she's still in that universe, I guess, so to speak. So I can be a little more forgiving about it. What I couldn't be forgiving about is I really thought that the way she was tricked at the end, I thought that was too stupid. I could not believe that she bought it. Like, no. I mean, I wouldn't trust anything. So, I mean, she should have known that. So, yeah, that was a little frustrating for me. Even though I've seen it so many times, that still was very frustrating. That all being said, of course, I give Nightmare on Elm Street, you know, 10 thumbs up out of 10. Because I think it's very entertaining. I don't think there's a dull moment. I do agree with Eric that, like, especially the TV death, there's just no way that that's a suicide. If I'm recalling correctly, there wasn't even like anything near her that she could have stood on.
No, there isn't.
To have done that. Like, it's just completely missing. So I'm like, at the very least, they should have thought that somebody at that mental hospital like killed her or something. Mm. But yeah, so that was very ridiculous and made the doctors look incredibly stupid. Although it reminded me a little bit of Johnny Depp's death scene in Part One. I mean, his bed devoured him. I mean, wouldn't the cops immediately think something crazy is going on?
Yep.
I mean, a bed ate him. So, I mean, I found out the bed had ate him, I probably wouldn't doubt my daughter as much when she's telling me that there's some crazy guy in her dreams. So, you know, but anyway, that's Part One. So, yeah, in Part Three, I mean, I really liked the characters. I thought, you know, I really liked all the kids in there. And it's got one of my favorite lines in it, too, when you know, Jennifer's introducing herself and she's like, you know, I'm going to be, you know, a movie actress. I'm going to be on TV. And Kate's like, yeah, Lifestyles of the Rich and Psychotic. And I thought that was a funny line because, I mean, he's just shooting down her dream.
Like what Justin does to me all the time.
Oh, ridiculous.
You are. I mean, you do kind of bully sometimes.
Yeah, Justin.
Who, Eric?
I left it open so you guys could decide who I was talking to.
Wow.
Matron.
It works on so many levels.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I really, when I was a kid, would get freaked out by the nurse scene, you know, where Joey is like with the nurse and like her tongue's like shooting out and like tying him up to the bed. I don't know why that freaks me out as a kid, but I always thought that was such a weird scene. But, I mean, it is Freddy, you know, and he does the crazy stuff in the dreams like that. Of course, the villain, Priscilla, you know, that Eric mentioned as well, she's very frustrating in this film. She's that character who thinks they're doing the right thing, but they're blocking any help the kids could get, like, at every turn. And that would be unbelievably frustrating to have to deal with. I absolutely, you know, love it. I really think it's one of the best entries in the Elm Street series. So, yeah, like two gigantic thumbs up from me.
Justin, what are your thoughts? Do you have any thoughts?
Do I have any thoughts? What do you mean, divine?
Because your brain's a bit empty usually, isn't it?
Oh, Eric, really? Well, to be honest, I was going to compare myself to you, Eric, but obviously I'll try not to now. But I've overwatched this film so many times and when it first came out that it feels to me, I've struggled to engage with it to some degree only because it's so familiar that it becomes a little bit flat. It's almost like just kind of, I don't know how to describe it. I think it's just like a song you listen to, you know, so well. It's 3 minutes have gone past and you haven't really engaged with it. Having said that, I haven't seen this film for a number of years now, and so I kind of tried to go into it with an open mind. And I remember when the film came out, I discussed before Nightmare on Elm Street, the original was the first film I'd seen at the cinema. When we went to the sequel, we were kind of shocked and horrified at the sequel because at the time, didn't quite appreciate that, compared to the first film, it was a very different film. It's a kind of charitable way of putting it, and of course, grown to appreciate it since. So part three seemed to be like a massive step up. It seemed to be very much a franchise that was on the up, and of course it was financially. It was kind of, every film did better than the last one. But actually, I watched it this time, and I agree. All the kids, the characters are really likable. You don't have those kind of real asshole characters. You've got Kincaid, who's kind of almost, but really you still kind of root for him. I like the fact that they keep Freddy in the shadows more or less for the first kind of half an hour or so of the film. I think it's very inventive without getting too silly. I think the problem for me is that with we've spoken about this before, but the Friday 13th films, before they went off in various tangents, the formula was so set in stone that I find them more rewatchable. It's the fantasy stuff that kind of starts to put me off. Once it veers away from the slasher template, it kind of loses it a little bit. Having said that, I think this film's got the good balance of the fantasy and the slasher in it. Freddy's not too much of a buffoon in it. One thing that kind of, looking back on this, is that it seems like Heather Langenkamp is kind of channeling Ronnie Blakely from the first film, in so much that her performance, I remember reading a review once that said that she was very, very effective as playing a teenager, and I think she was actually pretty good in Nightmare on Elm Street. But in this, it's playing a kind of a dream therapist or whatever she's meant to be is a little bit beyond her, I think. I think she's better in New Nightmare playing herself, but I think she struggles to carry that role a little bit, and it does kind of remind me of Ronnie Blakely. Maybe that was some kind of weird meta thing that she was channeling Ronnie Blakely for effect in this, but... I like it. I mean, it's a film that I've seen so many times now that I find it just kind of washes over me a little bit. Some scenes really stand out. The scene with the nurse. Am I right in thinking, I can't remember if this is true or not, that they were going to have Freddy's face on with yes. boobies? Was that right? Wasn't yeah. it? So he's yeah. gone. Because that would have been really good. There were some things, I think they kind of toned it down. I think they could have gone there a little bit further with some of the stuff to give it a lot. Because Wes Craven is known for kind of that kind of extra, not exactly perversity, but kind of left field touches in a lot of his films that went places that other filmmakers may not have gone to. And so I've got a feeling that his vision of the film was kind of toned down a little bit. I also sort of was reading, without going to the background particularly, but the giant snake was originally kind of pink, and they said it looked too much like a phallus. But I would have thought that was almost like the point. It would have been to have this giant cock sort of attacking these characters would have been, they had that, and sort of Freddy with the kind of silicone boobs and stuff like that would have just lifted it a little bit more into the slightly kind of in mindfuck. Whereas I think it does play a little bit safe sometimes, and the whole Dungeons and Dragons thing, like I say, it dates it, and it's almost a little bit too cutesy. But then you've got the scene with the kid being the marionette with like the slitting his wrists and his ankles and pulling his veins out and making him walk, which is, like things like that are kind of ghoulish, great ghoulish fun and very, very iconic, with the images of Freddy towering above literally above the tower, looking down like this massive kind of like almost like a Freddy Zilla. Sort of looking down, I thought that those kind of touches were really good, but yeah, I think it's kind of almost like a film I need to I don't know, sort of like give another 10, 20 years before I revisit it again, just to sort of try and get a fresher take on it. But you know, it's good compared to some of the later films. It's a masterpiece. But I give me one and two, you know, really over any of the sequels.
I would tend to agree. Joseph?
Okay, well, I watched Dream Warriors for the first time in about 10 or 15 years, just a few nights ago. I was actually surprised at how well it, you know, not only held up, but, you know, kind of how well it, you know, traipsed a very thin line between gallows humor and kind of pitch black horror and some tension in there as well. I thought Freddy's first appearance with Kristen stuck in that kind of glue substance, I thought that was pretty terrifying with you know, Robert Englund kind of jaunting toward her in the hallway, with the film kind of slowed down to half speed. And he swipes at her and she just kind of lunges out of that substance like at the last second. I thought that was kind of, you know, kind of tense. I think the film also works because it, you know, like Justin said, it keeps Freddy in the shadows for the first half, you know, more than it, you know, places him under a spotlight. I think, you know, them opting instead to spend more time with, you know, his victims to be, you know, for character development, I think that's a better touch than just kind of, you know, focusing on Freddy too much. And I, you know, like you guys have said, these are some kids you actually care about. You know, each one's, you know, very likable despite their kind of dream malaise. I mean, if this film were made today, it kind of stands to reason they'd be, you know, shouting at one another, cursing and, you know, all that kind of stuff. I mean, they do a little of that here, but it's definitely, you know, more so in service of the story rather than, you know, look at how much foul language I can cram into one take. You know, Chuck Russell's direction, I think, really aids the dream logic. You know, there's a lot of medium and long shots and not a lot of close-ups, so it actually kind of feels like you're in the dream, kind of witnessing everything from afar, as you do in dreams, typically. You know, he had previously written the script for Dreamscape, which is a similar movie with going into other people's dreams and things like that. So I think he had you know, he was a good choice for the director because he had the eye for it. As Justin said, I think the scene where Freddy turns Philip into a marionette, I think that's it's both kind of look at how neat this is and holy shit, this is scary. And it's probably one of my favorite Freddy kills of the entire series. For me, I think the Elm Street films sort of kind of reached their apex with Dream Warriors. The subsequent entries never really kind of captured the magic that I found in this film. I mean, there's some spectacular special effects that, you know, most of them still hold up even today. Some really good direction. I think Freddy toes the line between a clown like John Wayne Gacy and a clown like Rodney Dangerfield, you know, never really kind of veering into one over the other. It's kind of that perfect balance. And, you know, like I said, all those well-written characters I liked. So I'm going to give it 4 knives up.
Very good. Yeah, funny you should mention Rodney Dangerfield, because Chuck Russell has something to do with Back to School, I think.
I don't remember. I'll have to look into that.
Yeah, as Justin was saying, I think the Dungeons & Dragons stuff was always problematic with me with Dream Warriors. I think Justin put it best when he said it felt a bit lightweight, and that's how it feels. It feels too lightweight.
He was a production manager on Back to School.
Oh, there we go.
The year previous, so yeah.
Justin, Back to School is a raucous campus comedy from 1986, starring Rodney Dangerfield.
Okay, what, TV or a film?
It was a film, yeah. Okay. It had Keith Gordon in it as well. So. One of the things I was going to say was it becomes really apparent in part three that none of the Elm Street films know how to end themselves properly. They all end kind of anticlimactically, I think. I mean, part one has the I turn my back on you and drain all your power and then shock ending. And part two has probably has a better ending, you know, with the bus driving off into the wilderness. Part three has this sort of throw holy water on Freddy's bones and then a sort of slight shock ending, on and on they go. I mean, none of them end. I mean, Freddy's Dead probably ends conclusively, but it's pretty lame. Do you have any problems with the Nightmare on Elm Street film endings? Anyone?
I don't necessarily, I guess, have problems with them, but to me, I felt like the very original solution for killing Freddy was the best one. And it's not the turn her back on him and drain his powers. I thought that was kind of stupid. But the whole idea of, you know, he's, you know, supernatural, but if you, like, bring him into the real world, then he's just a human that you could just kill. And I think that was the best way to decide, you know, like, oh, this is, you know, how to kill him. But, of course, it made a lot of money, so they wanted to make more. So, of course, that didn't work. Yeah. But to me, I thought that was the best, you know, like, method to kill him.
Yeah, I would agree. But as you said, it would have stopped at part one then if that had worked.
Yeah.
Because I heard kind of conflicting things that Wes Craven didn't think the film could be sequelized. He didn't think there was a franchise in it. But then on the other hand, I heard that his making Nightmare on Elm Street in the first place was his you know, he was aiming to try and get a slice of that kind of franchise pie.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the big 80s franchises, we're talking like Halloween, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, and, you know, probably Texas Chainsaw Massacre as well. Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is the one that I've altered my opinion on most. Not that I hate them now, but they haven't aged as well. I mean, Friday the 13th has matured better, like a fine wine or cheese.
I think more insulting than how they kill Freddy in each installment is how they bring him back. I mean, there's one where he gets brought back by Dog P.
Yep, that's the next one.
When you start bringing Freddy back via urine, I start to wonder.
Yeah, we'll get onto that when we discuss part four on the next.
Is that the one with the girl who has the giant hair and she turns into a cockroach?
That's the one.
Yeah,
okay. I've always wondered the logic about resurrecting Freddy with magic dog wee.
You know, funny story. Last night, I believe it was, or the night before, I was talking to Wes about...
Craven?
Wes Craven. That's who I married.
Sorry for your loss.
I was talking to my husband, Wes, who is not Craven, about... you know, and he always asked me, well, how does Freddy keep coming back? Because he hasn't really seen all the Nightmare on Elm Street movies. And I mentioned that in part four, he was brought back by a dog pee. And Wes is like, yeah, real funny, whatever. He's like, no, how did he really come back? And I'm like, no, I'm actually being serious. It took me a little bit of convincing, but eventually he realized that I was not joking, as he thought it was a joke.
Yes. It's pretty ridiculous.
Did you say this was yesterday?
Yeah, April Fools.
Yeah.
Oh, then that's probably why I thought I was joking.
Yeah.
Did you see that 88 Films when we bring out The Slayer on DVD, on Blu-ray?
Oh, well, I saw the
there's a people mad about that one.
Yeah.
The April Fools. Yes, we're working with Code Red.
Yeah, working in conjunction with Code Red.
I think the joke is funny, actually.
Yeah.
So they're not actually bringing it out on Blu-ray. Sorry, people. Not yet, anyway. Hopefully someday soon.
I think Code Red have got the rights to that, so it may never see the light of day. But yes. Well, do you want to talk a little bit about some more background, Eric?
Yeah, anyone got any background, Nathan? Some background.
I got one thing. I didn't do a whole lot because this is, like we've said, you know, Friday 13 and stuff, that it's one of those movies that everybody knows all the main stories about it anyway. But just a little piece of information is Penelope Sudro, who played Jennifer in this movie, was in an anthology that me and Joseph both love. Joseph, do you know what it is?
After Midnight?
Yep. She played the girl and one of the girls in the dog.
That's right, yeah. I haven't seen that in a while. I need to watch it again.
Yeah, I love After Midnight. But yeah, I mean, she was in that horror movie just 2 years after Nightmare on Elm Street 3. She was also on Mama's Family.
Coming up next, an hour-long episode of Mama's Family. Yes.
Yes.
Never heard of Mama's Family.
Oh, I love it.
Yeah. Joseph, do you have any background for us?
No, I didn't really want to do background on a movie where everyone knows everything. So I thought I'd talk of, like, you know, a little bit of anecdotes, just past things that happened. I remember, well, vaguely, there was a movie theater, I think I've spoken about this before, called Battlefield 5, or I think that was what it was called. But anyway, that's kind of redundant, but they used to do like horror themes when they'd have horror films, and they had one where the it was Nightmare on Elm Street 3, or it may have been 4, but I think it was 3, with a Freddy kind of mannequin in a coffin leading into the theater. And also my older brother, who's a musician, his band in 1987 when this film came out, they played at a like Follies. They called them Follies. It's like basically kind of like a big battle of the bands, and they did the Doc and Dream Warriors song. And they had a friend of theirs running around on stage in a Freddy costume, like kind of terrorizing them as they were playing the song.
Did your brother have the hair to match Dokken?
No, his hair was never like, I mean, he had long hair, like, you know, like a typical metal musician, but he never really had like poofy hair. He just kind of had the long hair. But yeah, he was him and his bandmates, whom, I couldn't remember any of their names. If I tried, they were basically terrorized by Freddy while they terrorized the audience playing Dokken songs. And I think one of my greatest memories, of Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is basically just I would rent this from a local place called Video Park, and I don't know, I always remember this being the film that kind of introduced me to the media ident that I always love that. I always love those, like,
Joseph intros. Sings all your favorite video idents.
Yes. Yeah, that's a good segment idea. No, I always love those items, but I always love the media one, and I remember this one being the one, the catalyst for me discovering that ident. No, I mean, I have a lot of great memories for this film. I mean, little asides that's happened because of this film and because of the Freddy character, you know, in general. But that's pretty much all I wanted to talk about. So,
okay, Justin, do you have?
Well, the same, really. I think it's there's so much known about this. There was, I saw on the Facebook group some people posted links to previous scripts of the things. So did any of you had a chance to look at those?
No, but I did spot a script extract on the Never Sleep Again documentary.
If you want to, I mean, yeah.
Yeah, well, the idea of... you were talking earlier, one of you, I think it was Joseph, you were saying about how there was a lack of bad language in this, and if it was made nowadays, everyone would be effing this, effing that. Well, the original script apparently was profanity laden. It was Wes Craven's original script, which was apparently much darker. But if you freeze frame Never Sleeps Again, you can get a close-up of one script extract, which has Freddy saying to one victim, "Cunt, I'll get you, asleep or awake, I'll shit on your corpse." Which sounds like it'd be a much more Justin-friendly movie if it turned out that way.
You know, I was watching this when I was watching this the other night. I was actually surprised at how many people in the cast that Nathan and I have met. I mean, we met John Saxon, Jennifer Rubin, Ken Segos, Heather Langenkamp. Who else? I mean, I'm sure we've met a couple other ones, haven't we, Nathan?
You name the ones that I could think of right off.
Yes,
hand,
I mean,
actually.
That's a good few.
So. I've forgotten how many people we met from this film.
We met Brooke Bundy, who played
Brooke Bundy,
the mother as well.
Yeah.
Yes, that's and right. She's the mother of Tiffany Helm, of course, from Friday the 13th, Part 5. She was the breakdancing chick, Violet.
Is she the one that does the robot?
Yeah. So that's she her, her mother in real life is Brooke Bundy.
She doesn't turn into a cockroach or anything, does she?
No, she doesn't. She just dances like a robot.
Okay.
Speaking of Brooke Bundy, actually, what did you guys think of Kristen's mother? Did you think she actually loved Kristen and was just neglectful, or do you think she was just mean in general?
I thought she was kind of the Justin of the film.
In what way?
Eager to get back to her booze than, you know, anything else.
Teresa!
God damn it, Kristen, every time I bring a man over, you gotta spoil it.
So she knows where the boys and the booze are.
Yeah. Oh. Makes her the Justin of the film. One other thing about the original script, Justin, before I get back to you, is that one of the original ideas was for it to be quite similar to what ultimately became New Nightmare and have Freddy appearing in the real world to kill and terrorize the crew of a movie crew who are making a Nightmare on Elm Street sequel, and Freddy appears in real life and starts killing them. Mm. But that was ousted. Of course, it went on to become New Nightmare.
Sorry, it's just that's such a good idea. Why didn't you not mirror, like, I guess, you know, kind of go more in him, like, taking out the crew one by one? I felt it was more, I don't know, it got a little bit more too existential to me, I guess.
Yeah. I have issues with New Nightmare as well, but we'll get to that in 5 years.
A few years.
Well, one thing I was going to say was just like a little, you might get this straight away, but do you know, did you spot the nod to the Nightmare on Elm Street 2?
Yes.
What was it?
I did. And Jennifer, the character Jennifer, is watching Alone in the Dark in the TV room before she switches over to the Dick Cavett and Zsa Zsa Gabor interview. And that was
Jack Shoulder,
who directed Elm Street 2.
Yes, well spotted.
She's also watching. Apparently, she's also. I had to get this off IMDb or something because I didn't spot it myself. But she's also watching Critters, which is another New Line Cinema film.
Mm. Well, it's interesting that Roger Corman was. I'm getting mixed up. Roger Corman's in Silence of the Lambs. Sorry, ignore me. That was getting my films mixed up. No, I was going to say the one thing I thought was quite funny because we didn't get Dick Cavett over here as a talk show host, but I presume he was quite was Dick big in the States?
I think he was. Yeah,
he was huge. He was a huge Dick.
Yeah, but he was. I read, and I don't know if it's true. Was he said that he got because it was meant to be another actress, wasn't it? That was going to be interviewed, and he got Zsa Zsa Gabor because he said she was so fucking dumb that he would never interview her in real life, so that's why he wanted her for this.
Which I've read that as well. Yeah,
which is
I think it's actually mentioned in Never Sleep Again as well.
Okay, which is a bit cruel, but yeah, I think it worked quite
true.
Probably true. Yeah, but it worked quite well, didn't it? I mean, it's kind of, but it also shows that I mean, not that Zsa Zsa Gabor was a big star or anything at this point, but it shows that how far the films had gained in popularity. That you could have those kind of pop culture kind of characters turning up in something as a kind of ironic nod to whatever. So because, I mean, that's the other thing. And we've talked about the Nightmare on Elm Street films that by this point, that I think the first film was a hit, but it wasn't a massive hit, but it gained credibility and sort of interest with video. I've spoken about this before, but when Nightmare on Elm Street first came out, when I was reading about it, I remember being down at my grandparents in Devon on holiday and reading about how the horror movie was dead, but this new film, Nightmare on Elm Street, had set the box office alight in the United States. So it was kind of like seen as a renaissance a bit. And then Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2, although it got terrible reviews, it made more money, and then Part 3 actually got good reviews and made even more money, and then I think Part 4 made even more money, didn't it? And then you had all the things like all the clips of Freddy going on talk shows and having all the kind of kiddies lunchboxes and pyjamas and duvet cases, which again we've spoken about this before, the whole weird thing of him
Freddy, a duvet case,
yeah, I think
it's duvet cover,
duvet cover case cover, well,
no, nobody says duvet case.
Well they do if they're carrying their duvet in it. So anyway, so but my point is, it was kind of this kind of weird thing where you got we talked about this before, the pop culture kind of anti-hero or villain who is a kind of child murdering paedophile who's becomes celebrated by children. It's kind of like only in the 80s, really, wasn't it?
See, I have an issue. I don't think Freddy was a paedophile.
Do you think he just murdered him?
Yeah. See, the remake, they made him a pedophile, but in the originals, I think he was just a killer. I don't recall them ever saying that he molested any children in the original films. I could be wrong, but I don't remember.
I thought they did. I thought they hinted at that. I thought maybe that just went.
I think it's a subtle hint, yeah, but I don't think it's.
Well, I think it's kind of he was a like I think Ronnie Blakely says through that vodka haze and sort of in monotone delivery that he was a filthy child murderer or filthy child molester in the first film.
She says, "Yeah, I remember that scene very well because I think it was well acted. That's why I remember it."
Well, I thought
Nathan, you see the funniest thing.
Well, I thought she was acting amazingly for such. She's obviously portraying somebody that was on horse tranquilizers, and she was doing a very good job at doing that. But actually, isn't
speaking of which, does anyone get that kind of Ronnie Blakely vibe from Patricia Arquette in this movie?
Yes.
What, being a bit flat?
Yeah, but I'm not. Sometimes I watch the film and I wonder, okay, she's acting this way because she's supposed to be tired and sleep deprived. Hmm. And then I'm wondering sometimes, okay, it's her first movie. Maybe she's just shit.
Well, she's not as spunky as you would expect the kind of like the final girl heroine to be, is she, in this?
No.
I mean, she is
like, if you compare her to Nancy from part one, like, you know, it's true. I agree with you. I don't think she's as, you know, I don't know the right word. Spunky. There you go. I'm going to use Justin's word.
Mm. Yeah. She delivers a line halfway through the film where I should switch on the subtitles and see what she says. But it sounds like she says, it's Freddy. He's heavy in the halls. What the hell does that mean?
Heavy in the halls.
Heavy in the halls. What scene is it when she says
it's that? Where they it's just before Joey is whisked away by the naughty nurse. Hmm. And you know where the room they're in where they're all being hypnotized turns into a kind of a cylinder, like a boiler room. And she goes, it's Freddy, he's heavy in the halls. What does that mean, you stupid girl? Speak English.
Eric's about to have a nervous breakdown over this.
Hang on. I have the movie on the background. I'm going to go put on the subtitles and find out what she says. You discuss among yourselves.
Okay. Talk amongst yourselves for a minute.
Oh, what's hey, that? That's not my... That's Australian. who's Australian on here?
That's Justin's voice.
My voice?
That is a southern person doing a British accent.
Okay. Well, I've heard worse. What? No, it's a compliment. It's a compliment.
Yeah, he's saying that I'm actually not the worst accent he's ever heard.
Yeah, he's saying I am.
No, I didn't say that, did I? Well, mind you, you do.
I'm the only one who's ever done this on the show.
Yeah, I can't do accents anyway. I'm rubbish at accents. So, but Eric, have you found the scene yet?
No, it's almost there.
The audience is on one thing.
Joseph, did you like her body, the nurse's body?
She was okay. She's a little too thin for my taste.
Okay, sorry. She doesn't say he's heavy in the halls. According to the subtitles, she says he's out there in the halls. But it sounds like she says he's heavy in the halls.
Oh, Eric, what an anticlimax.
It's her stupid delivery.
Well, have we got any other background or?
Yeah, I have some here.
Oh, yes, you have none. Yes.
Okay, filming started in September of 1986, which just happened to be the month I started secondary school. I was skinny then and had a big mop of hair, and my friend Keith told me I looked a bit like Ian McCulloch from Echo and the Bunnymen. So there we go.
Did you go to a blind school?
Sorry?
Did you go to a blind school?
I'm going to dignify that with an answer. It opened on February the 27th, 1987, which was 10 days after my 13th birthday, when I was skinny and had a mop of hair, and my friend Keith told me I looked like Ian McCulloch from Echo and the Bunnymen. It debuted at number one, ousting Platoon off the top spot. You still there?
Yeah, we're listening.
Okay. We're listening.
Eric, did you ever sing The Killing? Did you ever sing The Killing Moon in school?
No, but I think I might, because I have possibly a new career as a singer. I might be singing soon.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Sorry.
Saying stay tuned to the end of the show to hear your debut. Yeah.
It made $45 million at the box office. It opened in the UK in October 1987, which is, 7 months later, and we had to wait till November here in Ireland for it to appear. It was banned in Australia upon its initial release. I think the ban must have been lifted subsequently because of the drug references, and particularly the syringe scene with Taron. It was nominated for Best Film of 1987 at the 1988 Saturn Awards, but lost out to The Lost Boys. It was also nominated for Best Makeup, where it lost to RoboCop. And Robert Englund was nominated for Best Supporting Actor, but lost out to Richard Dawson, I don't know who he is, in The Running Man. Bradley Gregg, I never realized this, he's Eyeball Chambers from Stand By Me.
Yes.
And he's the marionette guy in Dream Warriors. Mm-hmm. Rodney Eastman, who plays Joey, has an uncredited role as a shoplifter in Chopping Mall. So I'll have to go watch that and see if I can spot him. The original home video versions of the movie replaced Into the Fire by Dokken, which plays over the opening credits when there's a part in the opening credits where Patricia Arquette, in a bid to stay awake, turns her radio on and a rock song starts to play. That was originally Into the Fire by Dokken. On the home video versions, it's replaced by Quiet Cool by Jay Ferguson, although subsequently the Dokken song has been reinstated because it's on the Blu-ray that I have here. Jay Ferguson went on to do the score, actually, for Part 5 of The Dream Child. I was reading a couple of reviews from the time, and I'm surprised that it didn't get the glowing reviews I thought it had by some quarters. I mean, Variety said debuting director Chuck Russell elicits poor performances from most of his thesps, making it difficult to differentiate between the pick's comic relief and unintended howlers. And Cine Fantastique, I have their review here too, and they were not that impressed with the film, which is odd for a sort of science fiction and horror magazine. I thought they were all sort of glowing reviews back in the day. They said it was well crafted, though it is. The effects work is piled on a little too thick for the movie's own good. Freddy shows up so frequently and paces his antics so leisurely that there's not much time for tension to build. So they said Nightmare on Elm Street 3 is surprisingly light on wit and empty of real terror. So they gave it 2 stars out of 4. But yeah, I was just under the impression that it was just met with universal praise back in the day, but obviously not. I know as well, I know it happened. I remember watching film 87 with Barry Norman, if you remember him, Justin, from the telly.
I do.
Yes, and indeed. He slated the movie, I remember. But it made it all the more appealing to me, saying, because I knew that he was a bit stuffy about horror films. So that's all the background I have. Oh, one other thing I was going to say was that the UK quad was originally going to be a still image of the Freddy Snake scene where he's eating, which sounds a bit rude, he's eating Patricia Arquette, which is something that Joseph would like to do, I'm sure. But they had to change that to a sort of a publicity still of Freddy in a long grey overcoat. If you remember, I mean, all the Elm Street films were released over here with different poster artwork than the ones in the States. In the States, you had that, they all had that similar, I think it was the same artist must have done all the original first five posters. What we got, none of them, we got different ones. And the one for Dreamwires was particularly bland, I thought, Justin, didn't you? Would you agree?
The quad was, yeah. Cause they
yeah, it's just, Freddy in a cloud of smoke, really, you know, grey overcoat, basically, yeah. Thought it was.
Because the American one was with all the characters standing on his razor blade, yeah. Wasn't it? His fingers sort of like, and him looking, you know, from distance. So, yeah, it was. I mean, can you imagine what they would have done if they'd had, like, the big cock, pink cock eating Patricia Arquette instead? That would have been even more controversial, wouldn't it?
Well, they say on the Never Sleeps, it was either on the extras in the Blu-ray or on the Never Sleeps Again doc, that the reason, one of the reasons that the cock is kind of green in the end in the film is because when they were looking at the original models, they were just modeled out of clay and they were grey, obviously, or brown, the colour of clay. And they got the okay. But then when they brought it to set, they'd actually painted it pink to look like skin. And they were all shocked, going, uh-oh, it looks like a giant willy. So they covered it in green goop to try and disguise the williness of it. But I don't think it works very well. It still looks like a big willy.
Eric, you were talking about the critical reception, and I was just reading a review from Roger Ebert, you know, half of Siskel and Ebert, and he says he gave the film 1.5 out of 4 stars. He didn't really care for it. But he says, if some of the special effects are good, the movie also contains a classic line of dialogue. The child killer, we learn, was conceived after his mother was held captive in a madhouse. He is therefore, and I quote, the bastard son of 100 maniacs. Now, that would make a great title for a movie. That's what he says.
That's all the kind things he has to say about it.
Yeah, he liked the special effects, but he didn't care about any of the characters.
It's very hard to guess with him what ones he'll like and what ones he won't like. I mean, I know he had a lot of nice things to say about Halloween, and
he loved. I think he gave the new Nightmare, I think he gave it like 3.5 stars, and so we're on opposite spectrums there because I did not like that film.
Neither did I, and neither did Nathan. I think, yeah. Jumping ahead to Justin, new Nightmare, yay or nay?
Yeah, no. I loved it when it came out, and I haven't seen it for ages, so I don't know, because it was kind of like a. It was like that postmodern thing, wasn't it, before it really took off with Scream. So,
And I didn't hate it when I first watched it. Like, Justin, I actually really liked it when I first watched it, but I watched it not long. It's been a couple of years back, but it did not hold up well for me at all.
Now, some of the acting in that is ropey, particularly like Robert Shea and some of the production staff of the absolute New Line just can't act, even when they're playing themselves. But yes, that's something we'll get onto in 4. Nightmare on Elm Street podcast time. Yes. So that's all I have, I think.
Cool. Okay. Well, thank you, Eric. Should we do some of the feedback from the Facebook group, what other people have been saying about it? Joseph, do you want to read some of those?
Sure. Sure. Simon Logan, who we mentioned last episode, Simon Logan, says, "Well, shit, not only did time get the better of me and you released the Innocent Prey episode before I had a chance to share my thoughts. Yes, I did watch it, but I got called out multiple times on the podcast for not sharing them. So this time I will not only make sure to rewatch, thanks to the Complete Collection Blu-ray I just bought, Nightmare on Elm Street 3, but to comment on it in good time, lest my name be used like some sort of demon summoning mantra." That was from Simon Logan. Simon Logan. David C. Molay says, "I had this on VHS growing up, and I watched it religiously. I never realized that the opening song had been changed until I bought the DVD box set years later. It seems off every time I watch it with the original Dawkins song put back in. I have the same problem with Return of the Living Dead and its soundtrack changes from format to format. My favorite Elm Street sequel, Lawrence Fishburne's best role, rest in peace, Zsa Zsa. Who gives a fuck what you think? Do you like my body, Joseph?" Well, I think you'd be more up Eric's alley, if I'm honest. But I have met David a few times in real life, so he would definitely be more up Eric's pooper.
Hey! I don't know, you're being rude.
I'm a rude killer. Yeah, let's see. David J. Gereg, I don't know. This was an early influence on me. Also, my first crush on an actress in Patricia Arquette. It also played to my growth as a kid figuring shit out. With the geeky D&D kid, I was. The punk chick, I was just discovering. And the mute introvert, I could relate. This movie resonated with its of-age demographic. While my developing taste would eventually skew toward more plausible worldly slasher films like Friday the 13th, Halloween, and Texas Chainsaws, these first three Freddy flicks, while not really scary, will always have a place in my heart and my formative horror hound upbringing. Let's see, who is next? Jenny Hall Cameron says, "I love this one, and overexposure didn't kill it for me. I remember when it first came out on VHS and looking at that wonderful cover and on the back seeing Patricia Arquette being eaten by a giant snake Freddy. It came on Fox all the time, and even if I already saw it, I'd have to see it again. Liked how the teens banded together to kill Freddy, although some had some lame dream talents. Come on, Taryn, beautiful and bad."
I'm like that in real life.
Yeah.
I don't have a dream.
Let's see. Just spoiler.
Yeah, thanks for ignoring me.
Spoiler alert. I was so pissed when they killed Kincaid and Joey in the sequel. Kincaid was awesome, and to dispose of him so fast pissed me off. I'm in agreement with her. So saw him on an episode of It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia and was still mad. Great pick. Still is good with me. Let's see. John Matthews says, "Elm Street 3... Elm Street 3 is one of the main reasons I prefer the Elm Street series over Friday the 13th. It delves into fantasy elements, adding a new epic layer to the series. Always been a favorite. I do slightly prefer Part 4, he says. But nevertheless, strong characters, creative deaths. I used to rent the hell out of the Australian VHS. Please see attached the unusual VHS art Warner Brothers Australia used, and I can't show you the art online. This was the cover art I knew as a kid, and it wasn't until years later I saw the iconic poster art." That was John Matthews. Let's see who's next. Mikey Faulkner, he says, "I was obsessed with this as a child. I rewatched the franchise last year, and it is a bit weaker than I remembered it to be, but it's still the strongest sequel overall. Also, I met Jennifer Rubin at Comic-Con in London 2 years ago and got a copy of a behind-the-scenes DVD on the movie. Still haven't watched it. P.S. Nancy has shit taste in men." I guess I would agree. I mean, Craig Wasson. He's kind of a dull guy, isn't he? Miles Hamer says, the series best in terms of tone. Freddie employs a savage dark gallows humor rather than the overplayed wacky office joker of the later films. With the inventive Willy Wonka-style executions, lively characters, backstory, cheesy Dawkins theme, Nancy, and yes, tits. This is easily the franchise highlight and the one you'd show someone who knew nothing of Elm Street. Vies with the original as my favorite, a 9 out of 10. Don Amici, who I think is dead. How's he? I'm sorry.
Trading places.
Sorry, Don Anelli. I read Don Amici for some reason. Anyway, Don Anelli says, always rather enjoyed this one. Probably has some of the best scenes in the series. The jokey lines aren't cringeworthy yet, and the action-filled finale in the dream world is quite fun. Even though I never cared for the series as a whole, this one is definitely the Toya of the franchise.
Wow, it's awesome.
I guess. I don't know.
Mm. Freddy's dad is the Susie of the...
Oh, Eric, how predictable.
Bob Hartshorn says, still really love this one. A big fat roller coaster of likable characters, great set pieces, and terrific special effects, with the standout being the awesome Jason and the Argonauts-inspired stop-motion skeleton Freddy. A really fun ride with Jennifer Rubin and bondage to boot. Oh, yeah. Go Dream Warriors. Let's see. Nick Yeomans, you are next in line to be read. And he says, easily my favorite of the series. After the classic first and unsure campy second, this towers above anything that came afterward. The next three just blur into one big Freddy mashup for me. Still struggle to tell them apart. Adam Dillon says, other than part one, the pool attack, and dance scene of part two, I've never been a fan of this series. Part three was okay, I guess, if you enjoy watching Craig Wasson struggle to act. Seriously, that guy looks like he's blown every casting director for every part he's got. Wow.
Harsh.
Harsh. Here's my take on part three. I feel bad for the Wizard Master. He was probably bullied a lot growing up. Even God took a shot.
Yep.
Yeah. He's got I am the Wizard Master. Let's see. Simon Logan. That's Simon Deja Logan.
Deja vu.
Yeah, Simon Logan. He says, and let me just reiterate, his name is Simon Logan. He says, an enjoyable mix of the darker, more serious original and the campiness of where the series was to go. Bob Shea had Craven's twisted script flayed back to its skeleton, then had Chuck Russell and Frank Darabont dress it back up in a spiked leather jacket and bright pink leg warmers. One of my favorite from the series and worth it for the image of John Saxon floating down, looking more like Nancy's fairy godmother than her estranged father.
Yeah, it's very Poltergeist too, that bit.
Yeah, it was. That was from Simon Logan, by the way. Chad Hemsley says, the best of the Elm Street sequels for me. I watched it so many times when it arrived in the video shop. I love the fact that you got a good look at Freddy's face in this one. The puppet death scene is the best in the series, and I fell in love with Jennifer Rubin. Beautiful and bad. Alex Bully says, first Elm Street I ever watched and still my favorite. I think the balance of Freddy being scary and comedic was just right in this installment. Jan Libar. Wow, that's an interesting name. I hope that's how you pronounce it. He says, Gareth has his say. This was the first nightmare film I ever saw, so I have a soft spot for it. Might even be the first VHS we rented as a family. We were late to get a VCR until my brother got a Saturday job and came home with an ex-rental giant silver top loader. I really enjoyed the whole idea of people having superpowers of sorts when fighting Freddy. So much that when I later saw the other films, I was rather disappointed with how they went. My main memories of this film are the tendon puppet strings and the nurse who gets her floppy boobs out.
Oh, let's see. Floppy, are they?
No, they were kind of perky. Yeah, they were firm and moist and meaty. Mitch King says, the last good Elm Street film, silly as fuck, but funner than hell. And finally, David Cook says, my three favorite nightmare movies star Heather and John and have the input of Wes. Coincidence?
Excellent. Yes.
Yeah.
So thank you, Joseph. Is that all of them?
It's all from Facebook, yes.
Okay, brilliant. Well, thank you, everyone who's written in. We'll play the. I'll tell you what. We'll play the contact. How to get in contact with the show. We've got some more feedback coming up after this.
The content of this podcast was provided by Justin Kurzweil, Eric Frillfall, Nathan Johnson, and Joseph Henson. If you enjoy our program and are willing and able to provide a donation, please visit us on Patreon and become a content designated subscriber. That's patreon.com/thehysteriacontinues. For non-subscriber PayPal donations and general feedback, our address is the.hysteria.continues@gmail.com. To listen and interact, simply search for The Hysteria Continues on iTunes, YouTube, Facebook, and Twitter. Susie versus Toya forever.
Yeah, so that's how to get in contact with the show. Actually, before we get on.
Oh, and
to...
that's my stage name, by the way.
What? Susie versus Toya forever?
That's not
forever.
No, like the Nathan Johnson, that's my stage name because I'm, you know, an actor.
Mine is Joey Sleaze, apparently.
Joey Sleaze. Eric Lust. Yeah, that works.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. I'll just try to think what mine is.
Gothy Gotherson.
Oh, yes, of course, of course. How could I forget?
Isn't it Justine?
See, it's funny, it's people like Nathan's got this like butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. It's got a
I
reputation.
Know,
but he's such a he's such a bitch.
Ever since the day he went out to pick that rhubarb,
I know.
He's changed.
You know, I'm only trying to live up to this reputation that you all give me when you called me rhubarb, and all I did was tell Justin that I still had more to say.
You've never
when
lived
he wanted
it down.
To move on.
Never lived it down, no. But if people could see, it's kind of like, you know those kind of films, I can't think of an example, but when someone's playing a character and they're all smiling and then the camera, they think the camera's off and they turn into a monster. That's what goes on when you should see the direct messages we get from Nathan. He's kind of,
my
he's,
last message was about me getting a manicure and pedicure, and my hair did.
No, but you were sort of say you're like the Mariah Carey of the podcast. You don't do stairs.
He is.
Mm. I am not fake nice. I am genuinely nice.
Mm, okay, well, we shall see. But I saw it's a bit like you know, it's like WikiLeaks, wasn't it, Joseph? Posted up something, one of our private conversations on the Facebook group. That's not even half of it. So
it's like the one time that I was kind of rude in a joking way, and that's what he posts.
Yeah, well, she'll see. Let our listeners be the judge of that. But just I was going to mention that we've got a few things next. We've got a we're going to be doing commentary sort of in a couple of weeks' time for the Arrow video release of Madhouse, the 1981 Italian-American set slasher, which we're looking forward to. We've also got the Pieces is out with our commentary on. And
did you say there was a delay for a couple of weeks or something?
Well, no? I think there's a delay in the deluxe box set vinyl. But the original, like the... not the box standard, but the kind of the non-deluxe version, which has still got loads of extra excellent extras, including our commentary, of course, is out at good shops everywhere. So that's definitely worth picking up. So let's try and think if there's anything else, any other news.
You've done a commentary track for Just Before Dawn.
Just Before Dawn, yeah, that could be out on 88 Films at some point soon. Hopefully, that should be worth a purchase as well. And I think there's some others potentially on the horizon, but we can talk about those when we can talk about them. But yeah, well, should we go on to some other feedback? Who would like to
yes.
go first?
I've got a big one.
Oh, okay.
This is from Jack DVD 78. Jack DVD 78 here writing in for the first time. A fan for several years now. I collect all your Blu-ray and DVDs featuring your commentaries. Yes, I have the Savage Water DVD and the Arrow Pieces UK Blu-ray is on the way to me. I need to comment on a few things I've heard in the podcasts over the years. Eric, I also love Jumpin' Jack Flash. I used to watch it over and over on VHS. Also, huge Dynasty fan and the spin-off The Colbys. For Eric and Justin, how can you not love Stephanie Beecham as Sable? As for Toya, I had never heard of her until the podcast. However, I do love rock and alt new wave music of the early 80s, especially throaty female singers, so I may have to look up some of her material. In my opinion, it doesn't get any better than Bonnie Tyler belting out Jim Steinman's Faster Than the Speed of Night. Faster Than the Speed of Light, is it? Faster Than the Speed of Night, I think, is actually, yeah. At a million miles per hour with lyrics like, "You're such a pretty boy, I'll tell you what to do and you'll do it." Speaking of the 1980s and big hair, are any of you guys fans of Satisfaction from 1988, starring Justine Bateman, Trini Alvarado, and an unknown Julia Roberts? Greatest female rock band movie, second only to Ladies and Gentlemen, The Fabulous Stains. Totally got a crush on the young Ray Winston in that film. Oh, interesting. Ray Winston is in Satisfaction. Didn't know that. Haven't seen that film in years. I do remember the big hair, though. Nathan, I love your picks, because how else can you tell the great slashers from the bad ones? Your podcasts are always great fun. Love it when it comes time for trivia and Nathan is asked if he has any and he says a no, sounding like a kid who didn't do his homework nor cares. Anyway, on to Dream Warriors. I watched the Blu-ray last night. Memories came back of me being 10 years old, renting the VHS before getting my own VHS, and that was one of those horrible Video Treasure EP speed tapes. Dream Warriors is the greatest Elm Street sequel. The film works well because of the great cast assembled down to the smallest parts, from Priscilla Pointer as Dr. Sims, Larry Fishburne as Max, and Nan Martin, who played Amanda Kruger, the nun. Jennifer Rubin had to have had a blast as Taryn, getting the best one-liners and sarcastic dialogue like, "Oh, right, that's the sort of thing parents tell their kids. Night, darling, say your prayers. Oh, and by the way, your father and I torched some maniac last night." Heather Langenkamp was one of the greatest final girls in film history with the first movie. In Dream Warriors, Heather had one of the most shocking death moments in slasher history. Her dad had just been killed, and he felt Nancy needed closure with her estranged dad, so by having him cross over into the dream sequence didn't seem odd. When the shock comes that Freddy had tricked her and Nancy gets killed, the way it was edited was shocking, with the choreography having Freddy throw her forward to the ground so horribly. As much as I hate that Nancy was killed off, it was masterfully accomplished. I think we touched on this earlier, Nathan. I think we both agree that we thought it was a bit stupid that she would fall for that trick.
Yeah, and no offense to our listener. I mean, I'm not saying that, you know, the audience, you know, should have known. I'm just thinking that if I'm Nancy and I'm in that situation, I trust nothing.
Yes, nothing. Surely she's experienced enough at this stage. Yeah.
I'm like, I don't trust a thing.
Yes. He goes on to say, I always laugh at the made-up drug Hypnosil, especially when Neil says he will put the patients on the drug and Nancy says to him, paraphrasing, "Do you think we can get it by tomorrow?" Sounding like they need to get it from a dealer, like a junkie needing a fix. It is noted on an ancient noisy computer that Hypnosil is experimental, so I'd guess not all pharmacies were stocking it. It makes for an amusing moment. I think Dream Warriors resonates with many misunderstood teens who can relate to the characters with their misdiagnosed dream issues, while adults would ignore what they had to say. Adults believing the teens' deaths were suicide, as if Jennifer was able to jump high enough and force her head into that mounted television. Well, there we go. We were discussing that earlier. Which was a great slasher death, which was among many of the film's great special effects work, along with the stop-motion animation and makeup. For a low budget of $4.5 million, you got your money's worth with Dream Warriors. Regarding the music score from Angelo Badalamenti, who is more famous for scoring most David Lynch films, the Very Saraband limited edition Elm Street CD box set contains the original score album, which used mostly different cues than those were used in the film. The film versions are included on the disc as mono audio bonus tracks. That's all on the film. Love the long epic podcasts. Don't be afraid to push it 2 and 3 hours. It's never dull. Of course, I know it is hard to get everyone together at crazy hours to record, and I appreciate it. And I almost had a heart attack when Eric was about to leave the show recently. Oh, I'm sorry for causing such distress, everyone. No one can leave the show ever. Really, don't think I could go a week without listening to a podcast, new or old. I love the recently seen portion of the show, but would also love if you guys would want to throw in recently purchased when possible, even if you haven't watched the movie yet, or maybe just a used purchase of a hard to find item that you may be excited about. Well, I buy lots of stuff, as you know. Isn't that right, Justin?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
I do.
Yeah.
I do buy lots of stuff. I can't wait till the next podcast or commentary, and that's from Jack DVD78, which I don't think is his real name.
Jack.
His name is Jack Holstein.
Oh, is it? Okay.
Yes.
Well, thank you, Jack. That was good to hear. You know, from a long time listener.
Yes, I've never seen Dynasty or the Colbys, believe it or not. Yeah, I know.
Eric.
I know.
I did watch them back in the day, back in the '80s.
I was an Outlanding boy, but I just didn't have the time to watch them all.
Lord, I didn't watch the Colbys, but I watched Dynasty and Knots Landing. I know both of them very, very well.
None of them hold a candle to Santa Barbara, though.
Did you watch Santa Barbara?
I think when I was a student, there was one summer where I kind of watched a whole load of Santa Barbara's, and there was I used to love it because it was so bad, because it was, I mean, I think it was like Amanda, who we'll be meeting, you know, we're having a little powwow with in London in a few weeks. Myself and Eric are meeting Amanda by night, Amanda Reyes, in London at her book launch. So very excited about that. We'll feed back next time. But I know she's kind of the daytime sort of queen, soap queen. Santa Barbara, I just remember thinking they had like an earthquake in it, and they literally had like two polystyrene boulders they would throw at random people. And it was so cheap that if you watched it, you'd have characters talking, and they'd be like on a beachfront, which is in some studio, and the same two extras would walk past backwards and forwards behind them, sometimes with different hats on, just to make it look like there was lots of people there. So it was, and then they'd always start it by going, you know, sort of, I don't know, sort of Montez being Anya will now be played by so-and-so this episode, things like that.
Oh,
so
yeah.
which I love. They kind of just change the actors and actresses all the time on it. That was years and years ago, but I remember that being quite trashy. So, yes, well, thank you, Jack. Anyone else? I've got one here, but Nathan, have you got
anything? Do you have a big one?
Oh, I've got, well, it's not an extremely long one, but it's...
Mine's huge.
Is it? Or do you want to get yours out of the way?
Yeah, I'm actually go ahead and get that out of the way. Okay. All right, it says, "Hello, my fellow slasher completists. Greetings from Sweden. Just wanted to thank you for an amazingly fun show. I found out about your shenanigans recently, and now I have listened to around 80 episodes. When I'm on my way to work, on my way home from work, during weightlifting, when I take a shit, etc."
Ew.
Not the brown word. You gave that to Nathan to read on purpose.
Yeah,
Joseph, you know
Joseph
what Nathan
totally
feels.
Wanted me to cuss, and he knows that I'm going to read it.
Okay, you don't get to listen to the show again, ever. You're done, Heinrich.
"Your four beautiful voices are in my ears. Ah, thank you. Tonight I watched the UK slasher satire Unmasked Part 25, also known as Hand of Death. I really liked it, and I wonder why I almost never hear anyone talk about it. You hear about other slasher spoofs, such as Student Body's Wacko, Leslie Vernon, and, you know, all the time, but Unmasked, never. Why do you guys think that is? I am well aware of that. I haven't heard all of your shows, so maybe you have talked about it before. Take care, Henrik. P.S. Unmasked Part 25 can be enjoyed on the tube if one so wishes." I'm assuming he means YouTube.
I don't like that film.
I don't remember much about it.
I don't remember much about it, but I don't remember liking it at all. I do remember not liking it.
I remember liking it, but I barely remember it. You know, the only thing I remember that I thought was, you know, that sticks out in my head is there's a scene where the killer tells one of the victims nonchalantly that she can run if she wants to, but chances are she's going to fall anyway. So I thought that was, you know, amusing. But to me, I'm just a big fan of the, you know, Student Bodies and Wacko and Pandemonium, all those movies.
I've got a feeling that that film was it got a bit forgotten because it kind of came out quite late in the 80s, isn't it? Because there was another slasher movie spoof that's never spoken about. Was it Sex Bomb? You ever seen Sex Bomb? That was the I think it's called Sex
Bomb. I've never heard of it.
Neither have I.
I think it was I'm pretty sure it's called Sex Bomb, and there was a killer with panties on his face. I remember seeing it in Gore Zone. Way back in the day. I'll have to look it up. I'll look it up. So to see if I'm making that up. But
1989, Sex Bomb?
Yeah, that's the one. Yeah. If you read the synopsis, what does it say? Have you got it?
A low-budget film producer begins shooting his next two epics, I Rip Your Flesh with Pliers and Werewolves in Heat. What he doesn't know is that his sexy young wife wants him dead and plans to use the film as a cover to do it.
That's the one I was thinking of.
Yeah, Linnea Quigley's in it.
Yes, that's right, yeah. So, I mean, I haven't seen that either, but that kind of seemed to have got, largely forgotten. I think my Unmasked 25 was, is it Jackson's Back? It was another thing they were talking about. I think it was quite gory and it got cut quite severely, so I'm not even sure if it's, there was like a an uncut version of it, but I saw it years and years and years ago, and I don't remember very much about it, but it might be a fun one to revisit, Eric notwithstanding, if you hated the film.
Well, I remember hating lots of things that I ended up quite liking, so I'll give it
that's a... true. You didn't like Last Slumber Party the first time you watched it, right?
No.
Or Terror at Tenkiller.
Well, come on. My opinion on Terror and Tenkiller didn't change.
Just to let you guys know, we will be revisiting Unmasked Part 25 at some point because it is a listener pick.
Yay.
There you go.
So yes. We will be talking about it, Henrik.
Yes. Fed Inkin.
I think it's Henrik. I'm very awful. If you heard me do the quiz where I was reading the Italian titles, you know I'm awful at pronunciation, so my apologies.
Is that the quiz that I won? I think it is.
No, you won the one that Joseph gave.
Oh, whatever. I win so many of them. They all blur into one.
Yeah, fake news, Eric.
Shut up, you.
Anything? Was that everything from Henrik?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Well, I've got one here, which actually, funny enough, also talks about another slasher spoof that doesn't really get spoken about. So let me just get it up.
You having trouble?
No, sorry, I've got it in my hands now. So let me just.
Okay.
Let me just pull this down so I can see it. It says, "Hi all, thanks for reading out my email on the Innocent Prey episode, much appreciated. However, fantastic though it was to hear your thoughts on Deep Red, etc., I was mortified to hear Eric read my salutations, and I realised I'd written Best of British and American, but neglected to include Irish, unforgivable." So,
it's okay, I don't mind.
Yeah, so Eric, a wholehearted apology to you. As penance, I signed up as a Patreon subscriber and donated to Nathan Joseph's Till Dust Does Part project. Hope this helps a little. Talking of which, well, thank you for everyone who signed up so far to Patreon. It's very much appreciated. And you're nearly there, aren't you, with your fundraiser from Dust Till Dawn? Not from Dust Till Dawn, from Dust Till Dawn.
From Dust Till Dawn. Yeah, I got George Clooney coming in tomorrow to read for got a week left, and I think we have $95 left to raise, so that's it.
Wow. So if you want to see their version of Dawn of the Dead, then donate to that. So, it carries on. It says, apologies and donations aside, I have a question. Have any of you seen the 2004 British slasher comedy Freak Out? Without meaning any disrespect, it's a bit of a student movie, largely budget-free, with some very shoddy acting, and made over a number of years. But despite all this, I did rather enjoy it, and the filmmakers clearly have a love of horror movies. So I wondered whether its amateur charms had been caught in your critical gaze. As ever, keep up the good work. All the best, Jay. I have seen Freak Out. It's about from 2004, wasn't it? I don't remember very much about it. I remember it having a certain charm about it. What about you guys? Have you seen it?
No, I
haven't seen it.
You haven't seen it? No.
No.
Well, again, that's something we may visit at some point in the future. But yeah, let's face it, we're never exactly going to run out of films to cover, are we?
No.
Yeah. So unless Eric has another meltdown and decides to leave, or one of us drops dead, then...
Hey, it wasn't a meltdown.
Well, not a meltdown exactly, more of a hissy fit, was that?
What's the hissy fit?
What was it then?
The practicalities of trying to find time to record the podcast.
But that was a kind of like the quickest kind of leaving and coming back. It was like a revolving door.
See, now
he's
having a hissy fit.
Now I'm having a hissy fit. You want to know about hissy? You're going to know about hissy fits now if you keep going on this avenue.
Okay. Well, anyway, no one's calling you a drama queen, Eric. But
it better not be.
No one would say that to your face. So anyway, well, is that all the feedback?
Yes,
I think so.
Okay, well, thank you, everyone who's written in. So we're drawing to the end, and of course now we're going to be coming on to the the cherry on top of the cake. Can we describe it that way? Or
yep,
yeah.
Just say in advance that you are all welcome.
Yeah.
I actually wanted to ask you guys something before we end the show.
Okay.
Because this just came out and we haven't talked about it, but did you guys watch the trailer for the new It remake?
Yes.
Yes.
What'd you think?
Am I the only person in the world who thought that the It miniseries was the biggest pile of shit ever?
Thank you.
well, Not fully. Now, I liked the first half that only dealt with the kids, but when they became adults, I was bored.
Mm.
So that's my feelings on the It original miniseries. Like, the stuff with the kids is good, because I think Tim Curry was really good as Pennywise, but when they're all adults, it's just meh to me.
I hated it from start to finish, and watching the trailer for the new remake, it looks like, oh, somebody's jumping on the Stranger Things bandwagon.
Yeah.
It's got one of the kids from Stranger Things in it, isn't it? One of the kids is actually from that show.
Oh, is it? All right.
Yeah. I don't know. Everyone seems to be fawning over the trailer. It just does nothing for me. I don't find clowns particularly scary.
No, neither do I.
And I did not like the original It, so I really have no interest in seeing the new one.
What about you, Justin?
Well, I loved the book. I absolutely adored the book. And I really liked the first part of the miniseries. I thought that was great. The second part, again, I didn't care for too much. But we watched, funnily enough, when we had our big screen kitchen cinema, I watched Silence of the Lambs last night on the wall. One of our friends who absolutely hates horror movies and was just about bring herself to watch Silence of the Lambs and keep on looking away from bits. Her husband wouldn't come because he was too scared of horror movies. You can believe such a thing. And she said she was completely phobic about clowns. So I kind of just accidentally put on the It trailer.
Accidentally.
I said, look at this film that's coming out. And so watch it. I thought it looks great. I'm really looking forward to it. It looks like it's really been really well done. So yeah, I'm definitely going to go and see it. I love Stephen King. Not all of Stephen King, but I love It is a brilliant book, and especially if they go darker, because a lot of the darker stuff that was in the book was left out of the miniseries, and apparently
it's going to be
what book? What book is brilliant?
It.
Yeah, which one?
Oh,
who's on first humor there? So. Okay.
Actually, I can hear a cat. Hold up. Can you just hold? There's a cat trying to get in. Talk amongst yourselves.
I'm totally with Justin on this one, because you guys seem to agree completely about the original and the remake, but I agree with Justin completely on this one, because he, like me, felt the same way about the original one, and I'm also very excited to see this one.
But see, the thing is, and Justin is hoping that it goes a bit darker, but the thing is, if you've got a cast of kids heading a horror film, it's not going to be dark. It's going to be kind of fluffy, usually.
Yeah, and there's no real suspense because, you know, children these days aren't really going to be in any real danger.
No, exactly, yeah.
Well, I mean, if it follows the book, some of them will be.
Oh, man.
Yeah, no, exactly. Yeah. So
I mean, I'll give it a chance. It may turn out to be, you know, really well done.
But
at this moment, I just don't have any interest in it.
There's one scene that's in the book that, even though in the context of the book, it does make sense, but I kind of hope they leave it out of the movie. Do you know what I'm talking about, Justin?
Is that with the fridge?
It's when they're, you know, one of them does something for all the rest of them.
I'm trying to remember, actually. I haven't read
it for a long time. To bring them close together.
Oh, okay.
Well, this is an orgy.
I can't remember that bit. I can remember the bit with the fridge, but
you're thinking of Madman.
No, it's a similar thing. But anyway, that will be interesting.
It's out in September in the States, so I'm imagining probably September, October-ish over here. So.
Yes. Well, there seems to be a lot. There's the Annabelle trailer, the new Annabelle creation.
I liked the look of that.
Yeah, that looked because it's done by the guy, the director of Lights Out. And that was good. So, you know, who knows? You know, it could be good. So there's a lot of stuff coming up. So I've managed to get two cats in the room. Margento hasn't made a.
Uh-oh. Have they broken his microphone?
Oh, they've chewed through his cord again.
Yeah. Oh, Justin. Oh, hello.
I think that was like perfect timing because he says Argento has not managed to, and then
it's like a horror movie. Yeah, it's like a horror film. Oh, I just got an email. Is that from Justin?
Hello.
So this is my bra.
Hello. Yeah.
Okay.
He's back.
He's back.
Justin's back.
I'm back.
He's the man behind the mask.
Sorry about that, but Argento just jumped up and knocked the
Argentina, microphone
out.
You mean?
Argentina, yeah. He jumped up and knocked the microphone out. So So that's what podcasting and cats goes together like chalk and cheese, doesn't
it? You're the one who let them in.
I know. Well, I thought he'd come in and be cute and sit on my lap and he'd purr into the microphone like he does sometimes. But he decided to jump up. And because I've got one of those USB mics that if it gets knocked out or gets knocked, then it kind of... Oh, anyway. So we're back for like the next 10 seconds as we... So going forwards... we're going to have a little break because we're doing that commentary we mentioned, but so we're going to be recording next in beginning of May, the first week of May or so there's going to be a little bit of break between this and the next show. But Joseph, it's your pick next time, isn't it?
Yes. Before I announce that, I'm going to do another round of the game, Facebook game.
Yep.
Joshua Grattan guessed boarding house correctly last time. So he got
Did you get it, Nathan? That's one of your favorite
songs? Yes, because Hot RCA Property. Joe and I used to joke about that all the time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So here's the three new clues for the new movie. Number one is... let me repeat that. Number two is spiked. And number three is... I want to rock. Dun, 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 dun. That's Twisted Sister, by the way. That's the three clues. So there you go.
Excellent. Okay, well, good luck with everyone with that. And what are you going to be picking next time, Joseph?
Okay, I thought, you know, we've done the Friday the 13th series. We've done the Nightmare on Elm Street series. So I'm going to... Oh, we also started on the Scream series, but we haven't really got far. So I'm going to take us to another series, the... slasher film without a slasher, Final Destination.
Excellent. Yeah, so that will be going back to, is it 2000 that came out?
Yep.
So, well, 17 years ago. And Eric's going to have a little bit of a difficult time because you don't like flying, do you, Eric? So it's going to resonate with you.
Neither does Nathan.
Really?
Yeah. No, don't.
It's plane crash sequence is too realistic for my liking.
Okay, well, we'll see. Let's see. It'd be interesting to see you revisit that one. But we're going to be going out, talking about going out in a blaze of glory. Well,
yes.
Here's the opposite of that.
Hey.
And do you want to introduce your...
This is a new up-and-coming hair metal band called Twisted Hysteria. on vocals, you've got Eric Lust and Joey Sleaze, and they're doing their cover version of Dream Warriors by Dokken, although it is credited as just Dream Warrior on the end credits of the film, although it's called Dream Warriors on the soundtrack. So,
So I would say charge your glasses because you're going to need it after this. But thank you for listening to The Hysteria Continues. I hope you've enjoyed this episode. And if you have, then please consider becoming a Patreon supporter so we can have many more episodes. And we'll see you next month for a Final Destination. So say goodbye to the good people.
Bye.
incidentally, I write a series of stories where I have a character whose last name is Ectomy. So his name is Mr. Ectomy.
Very good. What's that from? Is that a quote from something?
No, I actually do write stories. I only let Wes read them. I don't let anybody else read them.
Hey, but you put your films up on YouTube.
Yeah, but the stories are even worse.
That's possible.
Yes.
You're glad you're smoking.
At this hour of the morning?
Well, yeah, because I knew that y'all were doing some singing thing, and I just cannot handle that.
Well, you won't hear it unless you listen back to the episode, so...
Yeah. Oh, okay, all right. Well, I usually don't listen.
Some velvet morning when I'm
Oh, my God.
Straight.
Oh, my God.
My ears.
Well, you going to sing a little bit for her?
Well, I was leaving thinking, is it like the song that goes leaving on a jet plane to Georgia?
No, that's Midnight Train to Georgia. No.